hospital surroundings suddenly seemed like my only refuge. There was no point in going home. I checked briefly on my remaining patients and went down to the cafeteria. It still smelled like a boarding school, but I sat down with a cup of coffee and sipped it slowly, wondering what I would tell Bree. It might have been a half hour later when one of the ER nurses hurried through the swinging doors and stopped dead at the sight of me. Then she came on quite slowly. I knew at once. I had seen doctors and nurses deliver the news of death too often to mistake the signs. Very calmly, feeling nothing whatever, I set down the almost full cup, realizing as I did so that for the rest of my life I would remember that there was a chip in the rim and that the B of the gold lettering on the side was almost worn away.
Said you were here. Identification in his wallet. Police said snow on black eyes. A skid. DOA.
The nurse was talking, babbling, as I strode through the bright white halls, not looking at her, seeing the faces of the nurses at the station turned toward me in slow motion, not knowing, but seeing from a glance at me that something final had happened. He was on a gurney in one of the emergency room cubicles, a spare, anonymous space. There was an ambulance parked outside, perhaps the one that had brought him here. The double doors at the end of the corridor were open to the icy dawn. The ambulance's red light was pulsing like an artery, bathing the corridor in blood. I touched him briefly. His flesh had the inert plastic feel of the recently dead, so at odds with the lifelike appearance. There was no wound visible. Any damage was hidden beneath the blanket that covered him. His throat was smooth and brown. No pulse moved in its hollow. I stood there, my hand on the motionless curve of his chest, looking at him as I hadn't looked for some time. A strong and delicate profile, sensitive lips, and a chiseled nose and jaw. A handsome man, despite the lines that cut deep beside his mouth, lines of disappointment and unspoken anger, lines that even the relaxation of death couldn't wipe away. I stood quite still, listening. I could hear the wail of a new ambulance approaching, voices in the corridor, the squeak of gurney wheels, the crackle of a police radio, and the soft hum of a fluorescent light somewhere. I realized with a start that I was listening for Frank, expecting what? That his ghost would be hovering still nearby, anxious to complete our unfinished business? I closed my eyes to shut out the disturbing sight of that motionless profile, going red and white and red in turn as the light throbbed through the open doors. Frank, I said softly to the unsettled icy air, if you're still close enough to hear me, I did love you. Once. I did. Then Joe was there, pushing through the crowded corridor, face anxious over his green scrub suit. He had come straight from surgery. There was a small spray of blood across the lenses of his glasses, a smear of it on his chest. Claire, he said. God, Claire. And then I started to shake. In 10 years he had never called me anything but Jane or LJ. If he was using my name, it must be real. My hand showed startlingly white in Joe's dark grasp, then red in the pulsing light. And then I had turned to him, solid as a tree trunk, rested my head on his shoulder, and, for the first time, wept for Frank. I leaned my face against the bedroom window of the house on Fury Street. It was hot and humid on this blue September evening, filled with the sound of crickets and lawn sprinklers. What I saw, though, was the uncompromising black and white of that winter's night 2 years before, black ice and the white of hospital linen, and then the blurring of all judgments in the pale grey dawn. My eyes blurred now, remembering the anonymous bustle in the corridor and the pulsing red light of the ambulance that had washed the silent cubicle in bloody light as I wept for Frank. Now I wept for him for the last time, knowing even as the tears slid down my cheeks that we had parted, once and for all, 20-odd years before, on the crest of a green Scottish hill. My weeping done, I rose and laid a hand on the smooth blue coverlet, gently rounded over the pillow on the left. Frank sighed. "Goodbye, my dear," I whispered, and went out to sleep downstairs, away from the ghosts. It was the doorbell that woke me in the morning from my makeshift bed on the sofa.
"Telegram, ma'am," the messenger said, trying not to stare at my nightgown.
Those small yellow envelopes have probably been responsible for more heart attacks than anything besides fatty bacon for breakfast. My own heart squeezed like a fist, then went on beating in a heavy, uncomfortable manner. I tipped the messenger and carried the telegram down the hall. It seemed important not to open it until I had reached the relative safety of the bathroom, as though it were an explosive device that must be diffused underwater. My fingers shook and fumbled as I opened it, sitting on the edge of the tub, my back pressed against the tiled wall for reinforcement. It was a brief message. Of course, a Scot would be thrifty with words, I thought absurdly. "Have found him, stop," it read. "Will you come back? Query Roger." I folded the telegram neatly and put it back into its envelope. I sat there and stared at it for quite a long time. Then I stood up and went to dress. Chapter 20. Diagnosis. Joe Abernathy was seated at his desk, frowning at a small rectangle of pale cardboard he held in both hands. "What's that?" I said, sitting on the edge of his desk without ceremony.
"A business card."
He handed the card to me, looking at once amused and irritated. It was a pale grey, laid-finished card, expensive stock, fastidiously printed in an elegant serif type. "Muhammad Ishmael Shabazz, the third," the centre line read, with address and phone number below. "Lenny?" I asked, laughing. "Muhammad Ishmael Shabazz, the third?"
"Uh-huh."
Amusement seemed to be getting the upper hand. The gold tooth flashed briefly as he took the card back.
"He says he's not going to take a white man's name, no slave name. He's going to reclaim his African heritage," he said sardonically. "All right, I say. I ask him, you're going to go around with a bone through your nose next thing? It's not enough he's got his hair out to here."
He gestured, fluffing his hands on either side of his own close-cropped head.
"And he's going round in a thing down to his knees. Looks like his sister made it in home ec class. No, Lenny, excuse me, Muhammad. He's got to be African all the way."
Joe waved a hand out of the window at his privileged vista over the park.
"I tell him, look around, man. You see any lions? This look like Africa to you?"
He leaned back in his padded chair, stretching out his legs. He shook his head in resignation.
"There's no talking to a boy that age."
"True," I said. "But what's this third about?" A reluctant gleam of gold answered me.
"Well, he was talking all about his lost tradition and his missing history and all. He says, how am I going to hold my head up face to face with all these guys I meet at Yale named Cadwallader the Fourth and Sewell Lodge Jr.? And I don't even know my own granddaddy's name. I don't know where I come from."
Joe snorted.
"I told him, you want to know where you come from, kid? Look in the mirror. Wasn't the Mayflower, huh?"
He picked up the card again, a reluctant grin on his face.
"So, he says, if he's taking back his heritage, why not take it back all the way? If his granddaddy wouldn't give him a name, he'll give his granddaddy one. And the only trouble with that, he said, looking up at me under a cocked brow, is that it kind of leaves me man in the middle. Now, I have to be Muhammad Ishmael Shabazz Jr., so Lenny can be a proud African-American.
He thrust himself back from the desk, chin on his chest, staring balefully at the pale grey card.
You're lucky, LJ, he said. At least Bree isn't giving you grief about who her granddaddy was. All you have to worry about is will she be doing dope and getting pregnant by some draft dodger who takes off for Canada?
I laughed with more than a touch of irony.
That's what you think, I told him. Yeah?
He cocked an interested eyebrow at me, then took off his gold-rimmed glasses and wiped them on the end of his tie.
So, how was Scotland? He asked, eyeing me. Bree like it?
She's still there, I said.
Looking for her history. Joe was opening his mouth to say something when a tentative knock on the door interrupted him.
Dr. Abernathy?
A plump young man in a polo shirt peered doubtfully into the office, leaning over the top of a large cardboard box he held clutched to his substantial abdomen.
"Call me Ishmael," Joe said genially.
"What?"
The young man's mouth hung slightly open, and he glanced at me in bewilderment, mingled with hope.
"Are you Dr. Abernathy?"
"Nope,"
I said. "He is, when he puts his mind to it."
I rose from the desk, brushing down my skirts.
"I'll leave you to your appointment, Joe. But if you have time later..."
"No, stay a minute, LJ,"
he interrupted, rising. He took the box from the young man, then shook his hand formally.
"You'd be Mr. Thompson. John Wicklow called to tell me you'd be coming. Pleased to meet you."
"Horace Thompson, yes,"
the young man said, blinking slightly.
"I brought a specimen."
He waved vaguely at the cardboard box.
"Yes, that's right. I'd be happy to look at it for you, but I think Dr. Randall here might be of assistance too."
He glanced at me, the glint of mischief in his eyes.
"I just want to see, can you do it to a dead person, LJ?"
"Do what to a dead..."
I began, when he reached into the opened box and carefully lifted out a skull.
"Oh, pretty,"
he said in delight, turning the object gently to and fro.
"Pretty wasn't the first adjective that struck me."
The skull was stained and greatly discoloured, the bone gone a deep streaky brown. Joe carried it to the window and held it in the light, his thumbs gently stroking the small bony ridges over the eye sockets.
"Pretty lady," he said softly,
talking as much to the skull as to me or Horace Thompson.
"Full grown, mature. Maybe late 40s, middle 50s. Do you have the legs?"
he asked, turning abruptly to the plump young man.
"Yeah, right here,"
Horace Thompson assured him, reaching into the box.
"We have the whole body, in fact."
Horace Thompson was probably someone from the coroner's office, I thought. Sometimes they brought bodies to Joe that had been found in the countryside, badly deteriorated, for an expert opinion as to the cause of death. This one looked considerably deteriorated.
"Here, Dr. Randall."
Joe leaned over and carefully placed the skull in my hands.
"Tell me whether this lady was in good health while I check her legs."
"Me?
I'm not a forensic scientist."
Still, I glanced automatically down. It was either an old specimen or had been weathered extensively. The bone was smooth, with a gloss that fresh specimens never had, stained and discoloured by the leaching of pigments from the earth.
"Oh, all right."
I turned the skull slowly in my hands, watching the bones, naming them each in my mind as I saw them. The smooth arch of the parietals fused to the declivity of the temporal, with the small ridge where the jaw muscle originated, the jutting projection that meshed itself with the maxillary into the graceful curve of the squamosal arch. She had had lovely cheekbones, high and broad. The upper jaw had most of its teeth, straight and white. Deep eyes. The scooped bone at the back of the orbits was dark with shadow, Even by tilting the skull to one side, I couldn't get light to illuminate the whole cavity. The skull felt light in my hands, the bone fragile. I stroked her brow, and my hand ran upward and down behind the occiput, my fingers seeking the dark hole at the base, the foramen magnum, where all the messages of the nervous system pass to and from the busy brain. Then I held it close against my stomach, eyes closed, and felt the shifting sadness filling the cavity of the skull like running water, and an odd faint sense of surprise. "Someone killed her," I said. "She didn't want to die." I opened my eyes to find Horace Thompson staring at me, his own eyes wide in his round, pale face. I handed him the skull very gingerly. "Where did you find her?" I asked. Mr. Thompson exchanged glances with Joe, then looked back at me, both eyebrows still high.
"She's from a cave in the Caribbean," he said. "There were a lot of artifacts with her. We think she's maybe between 150 and 200 years old."
"She's what?" Joe was grinning broadly, enjoying his joke.
"Our friend Mr. Thompson here is from the anthropology department at Harvard," he said. "His friend Wicklow knows me. Asked me would I have a look at this skeleton, to tell them what I could about it."
"The nerve of you," I said indignantly. "I thought she was some unidentified body the coroner's office dragged in."
"Well, she's unidentified," Joe pointed out, "and certainly liable to stay that way."
He rooted about in the cardboard box like a terrier. The end flap said, "Picked sweet corn."
"Now, what have we got here?"
he said, and very carefully drew out a plastic sack containing a jumble of vertebrae.
"She was in pieces when we got her," Horace explained.
"Ooh, the head bone connected to the neck bone,"
Joe sang softly, laying out the vertebrae along the edge of the desk. His stubby fingers darted skilfully among the bones, nudging them into alignment.
"The neck bone connected to the back bone."
"Don't pay any attention to him," I told Horace. "You'll just encourage him."
"Now hear the word of the Lord,"
he finished triumphantly.
"Jesus Christ, LJ, you're something else. Look here."
Horace Thompson and I bent obediently over the line of spiky vertebral bones. The wide body of the axis had a deep gouge. The posterior zygapophysis had broken clean off, and the fracture plane went completely through the centrum of the bone.
"A broken neck?" Thompson asked, peering interestedly. "Yeah, but more than that, I think."
Joe's finger moved over the line of the fracture plane.
"See here. The bone's not just cracked. It's gone right there. Somebody tried to cut this lady's head clean off with a dull blade," he concluded with relish.
Horace Thompson was looking at me queerly.
"How did you know she'd been killed, Dr. Randall?" he asked.
I could feel the blood rising in my face. "I don't know," I said. "She felt like it, that's all."
"Really?"
He blinked a few times, but didn't press me further.
"How odd." "She does it all the time," Joe informed him, squinting at the femur he was measuring with a pair of calipers. "Mostly on live people, though. Best diagnostician I ever saw."
He set down the calipers and picked up a small plastic ruler.
"A cave, you said?" "We think it was a secret slave burial," Mr. Thompson explained, blushing.
And I suddenly realized why he had seemed so abashed when he realized which of us was the Dr. Abernathy he had been sent to see. Joe shot him a sudden sharp glance, but then bent back to his work. He kept humming "Dem Dry Bones" faintly to himself as he measured the pelvic inlet, then went to the legs, this time concentrating on the tibia. Finally he straightened up, shaking his head.
"Not a slave," he said.
Horace blinked.
"But she must have been," he said. "The things we found with her. A clear African influence."
"No," Joe said flatly. He tapped the long femur where it rested on his desk. His fingernail clicked on the dry bone.
She wasn't black.
You can tell that from bones.
Horace Thompson was visibly agitated. But I thought... That paper by Jensen, I mean. Theories about racial physical differences largely exploded.
He blushed scarlet, unable to finish.
Oh, they're here, said Joe,
very dryly indeed.
If you want to think blacks and whites are equal under the skin, be my guest. But it ain't scientifically so.
He turned and pulled a book from the shelf behind him.
Tables of Skeletal Variants, the title read. Take a look at this, Joe invited. You can see the difference in a lot of bones, but especially in the leg bones. Blacks have a completely different femur to tibia ratio than whites do, and that lady,
he pointed to the skeleton on his desk,
was white. Caucasian. No question about it. Oh,
Horace Thompson murmured.
Well, I'll have to think. I mean, it was very kind of you to look at her for me. Thank you, he added with an awkward little bow.
We silently watched him bundle his bones back into the picked sweet box, and then he was gone, pausing at the door to give us both another brief bob of the head. Joe gave a short laugh as the door closed behind him.
Want to bet he takes her down to Rutgers for a second opinion?
Academics don't give up theories easily, I said, shrugging. I lived with one long enough to know that.
Joe snorted again.
So you did. Well, now that we've got Mr. Thompson and his dead white lady sorted out, what can I do for you, LJ?
I took a deep breath and turned to face him. I need an honest opinion from somebody I can depend on to be objective. No, I amended. I take that back. I need an opinion, and then, depending on the opinion, maybe a favour.
No problem, Joe assured me, especially the opinion. My specialty opinions.
He rocked back in his chair, unfolded his gold-rimmed glasses, and set them firmly atop his broad nose. Then he folded his hands across his chest, fingers steepled, and nodded at me.
Shoot.
Am I sexually attractive?
I demanded. His eyes always reminded me of toffee drops with their warm golden brown colour.
Now they went completely round, enhancing the resemblance.
Then they narrowed, but he didn't answer immediately.
He looked me over carefully, head to toe.
It's a trick question, right? He said. I give you an answer, and one of those women's libbers jumps out from behind the door, yells, "Sexist pig!" and hits me over the head with a sign that says, "Castrate male chauvinists," huh?
No, I assured him. A sexist male chauvinist answer is basically what I want.
Oh, okay. As long as we're straight, then.
He resumed his perusal, squinting closely as I stood up straight.
Skinny white broad with too much hair, but a great ass,
he said at last.
Nice tits, too, he added, with a cordial nod. That what you want to know?
Yes, I said, relaxing my rigid posture. That's exactly what I wanted to know. It isn't the sort of question you can ask just anybody. He pursed his lips in a silent whistle, then threw back his head and roared with delight.
Lady Jane, you've got you a man.
I felt the blood rising in my cheeks, but tried to keep my dignity.
I don't know. Maybe. Just maybe. Maybe hell. Jesus Christ on a piece of toast, LJ. It's about time.
Kindly quit cackling, I said, lowering myself into his visitor's chair. It doesn't become a man of your years and station.
My years? Oh, ho,
he said, peering shrewdly at me through the glasses.
He's younger than you. That's what you're worried about.
Not a lot, I said, the blush beginning to recede. But I haven't seen him in 20 years.
You're the only person I know who's known me for a long time. Have I changed terribly since we met? I looked at him straight on, demanding honesty. He looked at me, took off his glasses and squinted, then replaced them.
No, he said. You wouldn't, though, unless you got fat.
I wouldn't.
Nah. Ever been to your high school reunion?
I didn't go to high school. His sketchy brows flicked upward.
No? Well, I have. And I tell you what, LJ, you see all these people you haven't seen for 20 years, and there's this split second when you meet somebody you used to know, when you think, my God, he's changed. And then all of a sudden he hasn't. It's just like the 20 years weren't there.
I mean, he rubbed his head vigorously, struggling for meaning.
You see, they've got some grey and some lines, and maybe they aren't just the same as they were. But 2 minutes past that shock and you don't see it anymore. They're just the same people they always were, and you have to make yourself stand back a ways to see that they aren't 18 anymore. Now, if people get fat, he said meditatively, they change some. It's harder to see who they were because the faces change. But you,
he squinted at me again,
you're never going to be fat. You don't have the genes for it.
I suppose not, I said. I looked down at my hands, clasped together in my lap. Slender wrist bones. At least I wasn't fat yet. My rings gleamed in the autumn sun from the window.
Is it Bree's daddy?
He asked softly. I jerked my head up and stared at him. How the hell did you know that? I said. He smiled slightly.
I've known Bree how long? 10 years at least.
He shook his head.
She's got a lot of you in her, LJ, but I've never seen anything of Frank. Daddy's got red hair, huh? He asked. And he's one big son of a bitch. Or everything I learned in Genetics 101 was a damn lie.
Yes, I said, and felt a kind of delirious excitement at that simple admission. Until I had told Bree herself and Roger about Jamie, I had said nothing about him for 20 years. The joy of suddenly being able to talk freely about him was intoxicating. Yes, he's big and red-haired, and he's Scottish, I said, making Joe's eyes go round once more.
And Bree's in Scotland now.
I nodded. Bree is where the favour comes in. 2 hours later, I left the hospital for the last time, leaving behind me a letter of resignation addressed to the hospital board, all the necessary documents for the handling of my property until Brianna should be of age, and another one to be executed at that time, turning everything over to her. As I drove out of the parking lot, I experienced a feeling of mingled panic, regret, and elation. I was on my way. Chapter 21. QED. Inverness, October the 5th, 1968.
I found the deed of Sasson.
Roger's face was flushed with excitement.
He'd been hardly able to contain himself, waiting with open impatience at the train station in Inverness, while Brianna hugged me and my bags were retrieved. He had barely got us stuffed into his tiny Morris and the car's ignition started before blurting out his news.
What? For Lallybroch? I leaned over the seat back between him and Brianna in order to hear him over the noise of the motor.
Yes, the one Jamie, your Jamie, wrote, deeding the property to his nephew, the younger Jamie.
It's at the manse, Brianna put in, twisting to look at me. We were afraid to bring it with us. Roger had to sign his name in blood to get it out of the SPA collection. Her fair skin was pinkened by excitement and the chilly day, raindrops in her ruddy hair. It was always a shock to me to see her again after an absence.
Mothers always think their children beautiful,
but Bree really was.
I smiled at her, glowing with affection tinged with panic. Could I really be thinking of leaving her? Mistaking the smile for one of pleasure in the news, she went on, gripping the back of the seat in excitement.
And you'll never guess what else we found.
What you found? Roger corrected,
squeezing her knee with one hand as he negotiated the tiny orange car through a roundabout. She gave him a quick glance and a reciprocal touch with an air of intimacy about it that set off my maternal alarm bells on the spot.
Like that already, was it?
I seemed to feel Frank's shade glaring accusingly over my shoulder.
Well, at least Roger wasn't black.
I coughed and said,
Really? What is it?
They exchanged a glance and grinned widely at each other.
Wait and see, Mama,
said Bree with irritating smugness.
See?
She said, 20 minutes later, as I bent over the desk in the manse's study. On the battered surface of the late Reverend Wakefield's desk lay a sheaf of yellowed papers, foxed and browned at the edges. They were carefully enclosed in protective plastic covers now, but obviously had been carelessly used at one time. The edges were tattered, one sheet was torn roughly in half, and all the sheets had notes and annotations scribbled in the margins and inserted in the text. This was obviously someone's rough draft of something.
It's the text of an article, Roger told me, shuffling through a pile of huge folio volumes that lay on the sofa. It was published in a sort of journal called Foresters, put out by a printer called Alexander Malcolm, in Edinburgh, in 1765.
I swallowed, my shirt-waist dress feeling suddenly too tight under the arms. 1765 was almost 20 years past the time when I had left Jamie. I stared at the scrawling letters, browned with age. They were written by someone of difficult penmanship, here cramped and there sprawling, with exaggerated loops on G and Y. Perhaps the writing of a left-handed man who wrote most painfully with his right hand.
See, here's the published version.
Roger brought the open folio to the desk and laid it before me, pointing.
See the date? It's 1765. And it matches this handwritten manuscript almost exactly. Only a few of the marginal notes aren't included.
Yes, I said. And the deed of Sesson? Here it is.
Brianna fumbled hastily in the top drawer and pulled out a much crumpled paper, likewise encased in protective plastic. Protection here was even more after the fact than with the manuscript. The paper was rain-spattered, filthy and torn, many of the words blurred beyond recognition. But the three signatures at the bottom still showed plainly.
By my hand,
read the difficult writing, here executed with such care that only the exaggerated loop of the Y showed its kinship with the careless manuscript. James Alexander Malcolm Mackenzie Fraser. And below, the two lines where the witnesses had signed, in a thin, fine script, Murtagh Fitzgibbons Fraser, and below that, in my own large, round hand, Claire Beecham Fraser. I sat down quite suddenly, putting my hand over the document instinctively, as though to deny its reality.
That's it, isn't it?
Said Roger quietly. His outward composure was belied by his hands, trembling slightly as he lifted the stack of manuscript pages to set them next to the deed.
You signed it. Proof positive, if we needed it, he added, with a quick glance at Bree.
She shook her head, letting her hair fall down to hide her face. They didn't need it, either of them. The vanishing of Geely Duncan to the stones 5 months before had been all the evidence anyone could need as to the truth of my story. Still, having it all laid out in black and white was rather staggering. I took my hand away and looked again at the deed and then at the handwritten manuscript.
Is it the same, Mama?
Bree bent anxiously over the pages, her hair brushing softly against my hand.
The article wasn't signed. Or it was, but with a pseudonym.
She smiled briefly.
The author signed himself QED. It looked the same to us, but we aren't either of us handwriting experts. And we didn't want to give these to an expert until you'd seen them.
I think so. I felt breathless, but quite certain at the same time, with an upwelling of incredulous joy.
Yes, I'm almost sure. Jamie wrote this.
QED, indeed. I had an absurd urge to tear the manuscript pages out of their plastic shrouds and clutch them in my hands, to feel the ink and paper he had touched, the certain evidence that he had survived.
There's more. Internal evidence.
Roger's voice betrayed his pride.
See there. It's an article against the Excise Act of 1764, advocating the repeal of the restrictions on export of liquor from the Scottish Highlands to England. Here it is.
His racing finger stopped suddenly on a phrase.
For as has been known for ages past, freedom and whisky gang together. See how he's put that Scottish dialect phrase in quotes? He got it from somewhere else.
He got it from me, I said softly.
I told him that, when he was setting out to steal Prince Charles's port. I remembered,
Roger nodded, eyes shining with excitement.
But it's a quote from Burns, I said, frowning suddenly. Perhaps the writer got it there. Wasn't Burns alive then?
He was, said Bree smugly, forestalling Roger.
But Robert Burns was 6 years old in 1765.
And Jamie would be 44. Suddenly it all seemed real.
He was alive.
Had been alive, I corrected myself, trying to keep my emotions in check.
I laid my fingers flat against the manuscript pages, trembling.
And if,
I said, and had to stop to swallow again.
And if time goes on in parallel, as we think it does.
Roger stopped too, looking at me. Then his eyes shifted to Brianna. She had gone quite pale, but both lips and eyes were steady, and her fingers were warm when she touched my hand.
Then you can go back, Mama,
she said softly.
You can find him.
The plastic hangers rattled against the steel tubing of the dress rack as I thumbed my way slowly through the available selection.
Can I be helping you at all, miss?
The sales girl peered up at me like a helpful Pekingese, blue-ringed eyes barely visible through bangs that brushed the top of her nose.
Have you got any more of these old-fashioned sorts of dresses?
I gestured at the rack before me, thick with examples of the current craze.
Lace bodiced, long-skirted dresses in gingham, cotton and velveteen.
The sales girl's mouth was caked so thickly that I expected the white lipstick to crack when she smiled, but it didn't.
"Oh, aye," she said. "Got a new lot of the Jessica Gutenbergs in just today. Aren't they the grooviest, these old-style gowns?"
She ran an admiring finger over a brown velvet sleeve, then whirled on her ballet flats and pointed toward the centre of the store.
"Just there, aye? Where it says, on the sign."
The sign, stuck on the top of a circular rack, said, "Capture the charm of the 18th century," in large white letters across the top. Just below, in curlicue script, was the signature, Jessica Gutenberg.
Reflecting on the basic improbability of anyone actually being named Jessica Gutenberg, I waded through the contents of the rack, pausing at a truly stunning number in cream velvet, with satin inserts and a good deal of lace.
"Look lovely on, that would."
The Pekingese was back, pug nose sniffing hopefully for a sale.
"Maybe so," I said, "but not very practical. You'd get filthy just walking out of the store."
I pushed the white dress away with some regret, proceeding to the next size 10.
"Oh, I just love the red ones."
The girl clasped her hands in ecstasy at the brilliant garnet fabric.
So do I murmured. But we don't want to look too garish. Wouldn't do to be taken for a prostitute, would it?
The peak gave me a startled look through the thickets, then decided I was joking and giggled appreciatively.
No, that one, she said decisively, reaching past me. That's perfect, that is. That's your colour, here.
Actually, it was almost perfect. Floor length, with three-quarter sleeves, edged with lace. A deep tawny gold with shimmers of brown and amber and sherry in the heavy silk. I lifted it carefully off the rack and held it up to examine it. A trifle fancy, but it might do. The construction seemed halfway decent, no loose threads or unravelling seams. The machine-made lace on the bodice was just tacked on, but it would be easy enough to reinforce.
Want to try it on? The dressing rooms are just over here.
The peak was frisking about near my elbow, encouraged by my interest. Taking a quick look at the price tag, I could see why. She must work on commission. I took a deep breath at the figure, which would cover a month's rent on a London flat, but then shrugged. After all, what did I need money for? Still, I hesitated.
I don't know, I said doubtfully. It is lovely, but... Oh, don't worry a bit about its being too young for you,
the Pekingese reassured me earnestly.
You don't look a day over 25. Well, maybe 30,
she concluded lamely, after a quick glance at my face. Thanks, I said dryly.
I wasn't worried about that, though. I don't suppose you have any without zippers, do you? Zippers?
Her small round face went quite blank beneath the makeup.
No, don't think we do. Well, not to worry, I said, taking the dress over my arm and turning toward the dressing room. If I go through with this, zippers will be the least of it.
Chapter 22 All Hallows' Eve.
2 golden guineas, 6 sovereigns, 23 shillings, 18 florins, 9 pence, 10 halfpennies, and 12 farthings.
Roger dropped the last coin on the tinkling pile, then dug into his shirt pocket, lean face absorbed as he searched.
Oh, here.
He brought out a small plastic bag and carefully poured a handful of tiny copper coins into a pile alongside the other money.
Doits, he explained. The smallest denomination of Scottish coinage of the time. I got as many as I could, because that's likely what you'd use most of the time. You wouldn't use the large coins unless you had to buy a horse or something.
I know. I picked up a couple of sovereigns and tilted them in my hand, letting them clink together. They were heavy. Gold coins, nearly an inch in diameter. It had taken Roger and Bree 4 days in London, going from one rare coin dealer to the next, to assemble the small fortune gleaming in the lamplight before me.
You know, it's funny.
These coins are worth a lot more now than their face value, I said, picking up a golden guinea. But in terms of what they'll buy, they were worth then just about as much as now.
This is 6 months' income for a small farmer.
I was forgetting, Roger said, that you know all this already, what things were worth and how they were sold.
It's easy to forget, I said, eyes still on the money. From the corner of my vision, I saw Bree draw suddenly close to Roger and his hand go out to her automatically. I took a deep breath and looked up from the tiny heaps of gold and silver.
Well, that's that. Shall we go and have some dinner?
Dinner, at one of the pubs on River Street, was a largely silent affair. Claire and Brianna sat side by side on the banquette with Roger opposite. They barely looked at each other while they ate, but Roger could see the frequent small touches, the tiny nudges of shoulder and hip, the brushing of fingers that went on. How would he manage, he wondered to himself, if it were his choice or his parent? Separation came to all families,
But most often it was death that intervened to sever the ties between parent and child. It was the element of choice here that made it so difficult. Not that it could ever be easy, he thought, forking in a mouthful of hot shepherd's pie. As they rose to leave after supper, he laid a hand on Claire's arm.
"Just for the sake of nothing," he said, "will you try something for me?"
"I expect so," she said, smiling.
"What is it?"
He nodded at the door.
"Close your eyes and step out of the door. When you're outside, open them. Then come in and tell me what's the first thing you saw."
Her mouth twitched with amusement.
"All right. We'll hope the first thing I see isn't a policeman. Or you'll have to come bail me out of jail for being drunk and disorderly. So long as it isn't a duck."
Claire gave him a queer look, but obediently turned toward the door of the pub and closed her eyes. Brianna watched her mother disappear through the door, hand extended to the panelling of the entry to keep her bearings. She turned to Roger, copper eyebrows raised.
"What are you up to, Roger? Ducks?"
"Nothing," he said, eyes still fixed on the empty entrance. "It's just an old custom. Samhain, Halloween, you know. That's one of the feasts when it was customary to try to divine the future. And one of the ways of divination was to walk to the end of the house and then step outside with your eyes closed. The first thing you see when you open them is an omen for the near future."
"Ducks are bad omens?"
"Depends on what they're doing," he said absently, still watching the entry. "If they have their heads under their wings, that's death." "What's keeping her?"
"Maybe we better go see," Brianna said nervously. "I don't expect there are a lot of sleeping ducks in downtown Inverness, but with the river so close..."
Just as they reached the door, though, its stained glass window darkened, and it swung open to reveal Claire, looking mildly flustered. "You'll never believe what's the first thing I saw," she said, laughing as she saw them.
"Not a duck with its head under its wing?" asked Brianna anxiously.
"No," her mother said, giving her a puzzled look. "A policeman. I turned to the right and ran smack into him." "He was coming toward you, then?"
Roger felt inexplicably relieved.
"Well, he was until I ran into him," she said. "Then we waltzed around the pavement a bit, clutching each other."
She laughed, looking flushed and pretty, with her brown sherry eyes sparkling in the amber pub lights.
"Why?"
"That's good luck," Roger said, smiling. "To see a man coming toward you on Samhain means you'll find what you seek."
"Does it?"
Her eyes rested on his, quizzical, and her face lit with a sudden smile.
"Wonderful! Let's go home and celebrate, shall we?"
The anxious constraint that had lain on them over dinner seemed suddenly to have vanished, to be replaced with a sort of manic excitement. And they laughed and joked on the trip back to the manse, where they drank toasts to past and future. Loch Mineagh Scotch for Claire and Roger, Coca-Cola for Brianna, and talked excitedly about the plans for the next day. Brianna had insisted on carving a pumpkin into a jack-o'-lantern, which sat on the sideboard, grinning benevolently on the proceedings.
"You've got the money now," Roger said for the 10th time.
"And your cloak," Brianna chimed in.
"Yes, yes, yes,"
Claire said impatiently. "Everything I need, or everything I can manage at least," she amended.
She paused, then impulsively reached out and took both Bree and Roger by the hand.
"Thank you both," she said, squeezing their hands. Her eyes shone moist, and her voice was suddenly husky. "Thank you. I can't say what I feel. I can't. But, oh, my dears, I will miss you."
Then she and Bree were in each other's arms, Claire's head tucked into her daughter's neck. The both of them hugged tight, as though simple force could somehow express the depth of feeling between them. Then they broke apart, eyes wet, and Claire laid a hand on her daughter's cheek.
"I'd
better go up now, she whispered. There are things to do still. I'll see you in the morning, baby. She rose on tiptoe to plant a kiss on her daughter's nose, then turned and hurried from the room. After her mother's exit, Brianna sat down with her glass of Coke and heaved a deep sigh. She didn't speak, but sat looking into the fire, turning the glass slowly between her hands. Roger busied himself, setting the room to rights for the night, closing the windows, tidying the desk, putting away the reference books he had used to help Claire prepare for her journey. He paused by the jack-o'-lantern, but it looked so jolly with the candlelight streaming from its slanted eyes and jagged mouth that he couldn't bring himself to blow it out.
"I shouldn't think it's likely to set anything on fire," he remarked. "Shall we leave it?"
There was no answer. When he glanced at Brianna, he found her sitting, still as stone, eyes fixed on the hearth. She hadn't heard him. He sat down beside her and took her hand.
"She might be able to come back," he said gently. "We don't know."
Brianna shook her head slowly, not taking her eyes from the leaping flames. "I don't think so," she said softly. "She told you what it was like. She may not even make it through." Long fingers drummed restlessly on a denim thigh. Roger glanced at the door to be sure that Claire was safely upstairs, then sat down on the sofa next to Brianna.
"She belongs with him, Bree," he said. "Can you not see it when she speaks of him?"
"I see it. I know she needs him." The full lower lip trembled slightly. "But I need her." Brianna's hands clenched suddenly tight on her knees, and she bent forward as though trying to contain some sudden pain. Roger stroked her hair, marvelling at the softness of the glowing strands that slid through his fingers. He wanted to take her into his arms, as much for the feel of her as to offer comfort. But she was rigid and unresponsive.
"You're grown, Bree," he said softly. "You live on your own now, don't you? You may love her, but you don't need her any more. Not the way you did when you were small. Has she no right to her own joy?"
"Yes, but Roger, you don't understand," she burst out. She pressed her lips tight together and swallowed hard, then turned to him, eyes dark with distress. "She's all that's left, Roger. The only one who really knows me. She and Daddy." "Frank," she corrected herself. "They were the ones who knew me from the beginning. The ones who saw me learn to walk and were proud of me when I did something good in school and who..." She broke off, and the tears overflowed, leaving gleaming tracks in the firelight. "This sounds really dumb," she said with sudden violence. "Really, really dumb. But it's..." She groped, helpless, then sprang to her feet, unable to stay still. "It's like there are all these things I don't even know," she said, pacing with quick, angry steps. "Do you think I remember what I looked like learning to walk, or what the first word I said was? No, but Mama does. And that's so stupid, because what difference does it make? It doesn't make any difference at all, but it's important. It matters because she thought it was. And, oh, Roger, if she's gone, there won't be a soul left in the world who cares what I'm like or thinks I'm special. Not because of anything, but just because I'm me. She's the only person in the world who really, really cares I was born. And if she's gone..." She stood still on the hearthrug, hands clenched at her sides, and mouth twisted with the effort to control herself, tears wet on her cheeks. Then her shoulders slumped, and the tension went out of her tall figure. "And that's just really dumb and selfish," she said, in a quietly reasonable tone. "And you don't understand, and you think I'm awful.
No, Roger said quietly. I think maybe not.
He stood and came behind her, putting his arms around her waist, urging her to lean back against him. She resisted at first, stiff in his arms, but then yielded to the need for physical comfort and relaxed, his chin propped on her shoulder, head tilted to touch her own.
I never realized, he said. Not till now. Do you remember all those boxes in the garage?
Which ones? She said with a sniffing attempt at a laugh. There are hundreds.
The ones that say Roger on them.
He gave her a slight squeeze and brought his arms up, crisscrossed on her chest, holding her snug against himself.
They're full of my parents' old clobber, he said. Pictures and letters and baby clothes and books and old bits of rubbish. The Reverend packed them up when he took me to live with them. Treated them just like his most precious historical documents, double-boxing and moth-proofing and all that.
He rocked slowly back and forth, swaying from side to side, carrying her with him as he watched the fire over her shoulder.
I asked him once why he bothered to keep them. I didn't want any of it, didn't care. But he said we'd keep it just the same. It was my history, he said, and everyone needs a history.
Brianna sighed, and her body seemed to relax still further, joining him in his rhythmic, half-unconscious sway. Did you ever look inside them?
He shook his head. It isn't important what's in them, he said, only that they're there.
He let go of her then, and stepped back so that she turned to face him. Her face was blotched, and her long, elegant nose a little swollen.
You're wrong, you know, he said softly,
and held out his hand to her.
It isn't only your mother who cares.
Brianna had gone to bed long since, but Roger sat on in the study, watching the flames die down in the hearth.
Halloween had always seemed to him a restless night, alive with waking spirits. Tonight was even more so, with the knowledge of what would happen in the morning. The jack-o'-lantern on the desk grinned in anticipation, filling the room with the homely scent of baking pies. The sound of a footfall on the stair roused him from his thoughts. He had thought it might be Brianna, unable to sleep. But the visitor was Claire.
I thought you might still be awake, she said. She was in her nightdress, a pale glimmer of white satin against the dark hallway.
He smiled and stretched out a hand, inviting her in.
No, I could never sleep on All Hallows, not after all the stories my father told me. I always thought I could hear ghosts talking outside my window.
She smiled, coming into the firelight. And what did they say?
"Seest thou this great grey head with jaws which have no meat?"
Roger quoted.
"You know the story. The little tailor who spent the night in a haunted church and met the hungry ghost."
"I do. I think if I'd heard that outside my window, I'd have spent the rest of the night hiding under the bedclothes."
"Oh, I usually did,"
Roger assured her.
"Though once, when I was 7 or so, I got up my nerve, stood up on the bed and peed on the windowsill. The Reverend had just told me that pissing on the doorposts is supposed to keep a ghost from coming in the house."
Claire laughed delightedly, the firelight dancing in her eyes. Did it work?
Well, it would have worked better had the window been open, Roger said. But the ghosts didn't come in, no.
They laughed together. And then one of the small awkward silences that had punctuated the evening fell between them, the sudden realization of enormity gaping beneath the tightrope of conversation. Claire sat beside him, watching the fire, her hands moving restlessly among the folds of her gown. The light winked from her wedding rings, silver and gold, in sparks of fire.
"I'll take care of her, you know," Roger said quietly at last. "You do know that, don't you?"
Claire nodded, not looking at him.
"I know,"
she said softly. He could see the tears, caught trembling at the edge of her lashes, glowing with firelight.